Oh, I know.
It's supposed to be a panel, but there's nobody else who wants to do it, so it was going to be just kind of like a free-fall form discussion about technology.
But it patches all the node poles, and it accepts updates, but only those which are cryptographically signed by the person that owns the password.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. But I would like to see, what if something like this went nationwide, and everybody says, oh, shit, I've got Palladium, And give people that sense of, you no longer control your machine.
You have no sense of control whatsoever.
Have every time you boot, have it say, I control your computer. Did you want to give up that control? Click OK. And the computer runs as normal, except 1 out of 10 times it doesn't let you install software.
All right, I'm sorry. I've decided that. All right.
Yeah, I'm probably not even going to need the mic for this one. This was supposed to be a panel discussion on peer-to-peer technology and issues surrounding peer-to-peer technology and what kind of impact peer-to-peer type frameworks have on different areas of business and technology and what you can use them for. And I was going to slant it more toward more of a free-form discussion on it and the fact that, my personal belief is that of course, everybody hears that you can use peer-to-peer for file trading and things of that nature, and there's lots of legal issues around that. But there's a lot of potential, and a lot of enterprise environments are starting to use peer-to-peer technology for things like redundancy of data and high availability of data. Commercial applications like LSF, where you use grid computing methodologies. And my strong viewpoint is that there's going to be a convergence over the next couple of years between peer-to-peer and grid computing. The idea where you automate, or you want your entire home automated, where you have your toaster talking to your PDA, talking to your lighting system, things like that, it doesn't really fit well with the client-server model as well as it does with a peer-to-peer model. So if everything becomes basically a peer in a network, then things become more manageable. Other than that, I was just going to field questions, and it was going to be kind of like a Q&A type thing about, how people use peer-to-peer technology. You guys have used peer-to-peer stuff, I'm sure, Nutella, Kazaa, Napster, way back when. Did you guys download anything other than music with it? You guys go after...
I write code for it.
Okay, what do you write code for?
The internet, peer-to-peer.
Okay.
Our interest is in publishing medical data anonymously,
okay.
Or things where there's a risk that you don't want people to know who's associated with
it. Is it similar to Freenet? Or?
Except it works, which is pretty cool.
Ouch.
It's not written in Java, it's written in C.
Okay.
And we have, anonymity and accounting, which Freenet does not.
Okay.
Excuse me, did you just call in here?
No. So the Saturday night begins. But how is it different from Freenet, other than the Java? Do you see writing it in C as an advantage or a disadvantage? I'm a big Java guy, so I can speak at length on it.
No. Just as far as programming, you just go, obviously, if you write something in C, you're opening it to a wider audience because Java is newer than C is.
Sure, yeah.
And so as a result, I think more people have exposure to C, but also... unfortunately, C is more portable than Java right now.
I disagree with that one.
I'm sorry, there's a C compiler for every platform.
That's fine, but you can't take the same source code, the same C source.
It
depends on how it's written, but more often than not, you can't take something you wrote in MSC. If you write ANSI C, that argument holds.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Which is what we try and stick with.
But a lot of the Java technology, even things like Juxta and even Genie to an extent, have this all-encompassing idea. If you guys aren't familiar, Genie's a Java technology where instead of using just a machine where you write a program, it compiles into Java bytecode on one computer, your virtual machine, in essence, is multiple computers. And so you write your application with the idea that it runs on multiple computers, you know, 50, 100,000 computers. And just your methodology, the way you think about things has to change a little bit because, of course, your resources are much, much broader than just if you were writing for a single unit. Juxta is Sun's implementation, their answer to peer-to-peer, and Juxta is really just a specification for routing protocols and certain low-level things, and people are building modules on top of that. So what else? Does anybody else use peer-to-peer for anything besides getting files? Not really. Distributed computing. Platform Computing is a vendor that makes a product called LSF, actually. And that's where it kind of crosses a boundary into grid computing, where you take pieces of a job that you want to complete and farm it out to different nodes, and the nodes aggregate the data back to a central point, and the data's aggregated at that point.
You mean like SETI or something like that?
It's similar to SETI. I mean, SETI has a very specific goal, or you know.
Right, but that's what grid computing is.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's the methodology. I mean, you talk about things like MPI, where you have multiple processors and things like that. It's all a similar thought process that goes on. But I definitely am a big advocate of a convergence over the next couple of years of grid computing and peer-to-peer, just because in a grid you have all these different nodes in the grid that you farm work out to, and you have the resources of all these different machines. And peer-to-peer, it's essentially the same thing.
Have you looked into like economic models for...
Like small world heuristics, things like that?
No, more like reward incentive models for...
Micropayments?
What's that?
Micropayments? Things like that?
No, it's more like, okay, somebody has these free cycles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And someone else is going to run their job on their computer.
Yeah.
How does that, what do they
what benefit? That's essentially what the idea of micropayments are. It's, let's say somebody on CASA is sharing 500 files and somebody else is sharing no files. And these two people go after the same file from the same guy. And they both want to download a Britney Spears MP3 from this one dude. But the guy that's sharing 500 files would essentially have a higher place in that queue because he is contributing to the network. He's contributing resources and information. The model has been said is fundamentally flawed, but nobody really wants to back it up and justify it as to why it's flawed. But, I mean, just the common thought out there is that it is flawed. I advocate it. I think it's a great idea to give people incentive to... Now, the quality of data is another concern altogether, because then you'll get people who make, you know, 1,000 one-byte files just to get, you know, depending on how it's architected, what you get credit for.
So it's flawed because of the cheating aspect?
Yeah, that's a part of it.
The reason I brought up economic models is there are economic models for peer-to-peer systems that they enforce this idea of acceptable leeching. So that, and it doesn't matter so much that people are downloading or what they're doing, but it's if you're not doing anything with your machine, if your load's like, you know, 0.01 or whatever, then if people are going to download from you, you know, what's the big deal? And so if you do those people a favor, you make assumptions that they know that, you know, and this economic model kind of spreads. And so you know what people you've done favors for, what people have done favors for you, things like that. And it seems to be a bit less problematic than... And the other thing is, like, there are some systems that they actually distribute chunks of data out to multiple nodes so that, you know, you have this file, you don't get blasted when people want the latest Britney Spears album. You know, they can get it from multiple nodes.
Nutella G2 works in a similar way. So does newer versions of the CASA protocol. God, what the fuck is the name of that company that CASA actually licensed their protocol? I can't remember the name of the company, but they actually... No, it's a proprietary protocol from a company in Sweden, and CASA actually licenses their algorithms and their protocols and their implementations and the libraries and bundles them in, and actually runs on top of that. And the company was really small, and that's all they do. That's their main product. But their main purpose is, I mean, CASA, they're talking about putting in newer versions where there is this type of, you know, background process, you know, okay, you're logged on to CASA, but we're going to run this process in the background, and we'll be able to, you know, push and pull data from your machine at will. and I think Kaz version 3 and up has have these hooks in it for people to dump code on the machine. A lot of big players are starting to look at peer-to-peer more as this convergence starts happening between grid computing and peer-to-peer computing. Microsoft invested, they just gave Groove Networks another $31 million, I mean, in tandem with, you know, Intel, Angel Investment Group, all this stuff, to basically, you know, I've used Groove. Anybody else use Groove? Groove application. Basically, it's a peer-to-peer application, but it has like a groupware module, group calendar, scheduling, you know, a whiteboard, chat room, all this stuff built on there. And they're all corporate tools geared for an enterprise, you know, work environment. So you can disseminate data very easily, even share files. It's not revolutionary at all. All of these things still require servers in the environment. And there's one of my pet peeves is that there's different degrees of peer-to-peer. There's true peer-to-peer, like a Nutella protocol, where you don't have this client-server relationship. You don't have a super node, you know, sibling node relationship in the network. The whole idea with peer-to-peer computing is that the network, you can cut its arm off and it still goes on living, like it didn't need its arm. And with Napster, it's a prime example. There were index servers. When you typed in a query, it would go to one of Napster's index servers. And when clients logged into Napster, they would hit these index servers with the resources they were sharing, the files they were sharing. So you did a query and it would go up against one of these index servers. You would find who's logged in with the file you want and return that in your result list. If those servers go away, you're fine. I mean, you lose all your functionality. With the very first iteration of the Nutella protocol, the network was entirely flat. There were no servers. It was a single tier. There were no servers that brokered data, nothing like that. The problem is when you start up and get into the network, if you're not aware of anybody, if you don't have like a seed list of 20 machines that you can talk to and get their list of machines that they know about and so on and so forth, you know, how do you get into the network and how do you find out what's available? So when people say peer-to-peer, it's kind of this bastardized client-server relationship. Nutella got around it. LimeWire provides seeding for, I think, router.limewire.com. There's a bunch of mirrored hosts that provide seed nodes. When you log onto the network, they give you a list of machines that they're reasonably sure of are online. And you try to hit 20 or 50 of them, you might get 6 or 7. But from those 6 or 7, you get all the nodes they know about, and that's how things roll. With Napster, you'd log in, automatically go to one of the Napster servers because it was always there, and you were guaranteed it was always there. Kaza works the same way. There are other things. There's always those central points, though, to get them started. And that kind of breaks the whole peer-to-peer methodology. If you can cut that arm off, the beast will die. And that's not how it's supposed to work. Grid computing is essentially the same way, only it's not so much redundancy of data and making sure the beast lives. It's that you use all these little beasts in the environment to do your work for you. But the idea is the same, that you have all these resources spread out, this huge breadth of resources, and you farm out data, you farm out processing, and you can use all that power, all those resources to aggregate a result.
What software have you used for peer-to-peer, like in a work environment, like for sharing files?
In a corporate, well, a little bit of my background, my day job, I work for EDS, Electronic Data Systems. So I work specifically on the GM account. So I have, and I more directly, we support the engineer side of the house, and we see huge applications come through, and lots of engineering applications like Unigraphics. LSF is one that we've done, and none of them really come close to using that methodology. LSF's looking into it.
As a system, like hard drives today, you put like 40 gig drives into like people's desktops. They obviously don't need that.
No,
much.
They don't.
So it's like, what if we could, you know, harness everyone's, you know, take a few gigs, like from everyone, keep all of our data there, and then our data's backed up because it's all everyone's.
That's Groove. I mean, Groove's a free download, and I mean, it does that kind of. It has that kind of functionality. It's not rocket science again. What rocket science really would be is to make a truly flat network. And when I say flat, usually you have a tiered network design where you have clients, you have servers, you have pseudo servers, and you have this tree. You have like a DNS server, a web server, and clients hit those servers. A flat network, there is only one tier, all clients basically, or peers. And if you get to that point, rocket science would be to actually efficiently, you know, you don't need to be seeded to get into the network. You don't have to rely on data from somewhere else, from another source that if it's taken away, you would die. You would not have access.
Initial seed.
I'm sorry?
You have to have initial seed.
Well, this is what I'm saying. This is kind of like the holy grail that if you can get away from relying on that initial seed of data to get into the network and to find out the geometry of the network.
What's the point though? I mean, if you were broadcasting.
Well, let's say I'm a client. Like, the problem is when you look at the network maps of peer-to-peer networks, you'll see it's called the small world heuristic, and it's like the 6 degrees of separation. You know, you're six people away from knowing everybody on the planet. That kind of thinking. And you look at these maps of things like Nutella, and it was not planned out that way, but that's exactly how it maps. There's these nodes with a very high degree in the network. They have a lot of nodes connected to them. And typically what happens is the longer nodes on the network, broadband users, people with T1s and OC3s, you know, they install this shit at work that are run for long periods of time. They sit in the network, more nodes know about them and can connect to them. And you see these very, it looks like a spokes on a wheel type thing. And what happens is, like, users that don't have broadband, dial-up users, they tend to sit on the edge of the network. They're leaf nodes. And the problem is that those nodes come into the network and go out so frequently that they rely on that kind of mechanism, that initial point of contact. But if you take that initial point of contact away, then they're stuck. I mean, the network will fall apart. Because just as those leaf nodes rely on these nodes, these high-degree nodes, the high-degree nodes rely on the leaf nodes as well to pass data back through the network. More and more people filtering in. This is great. Anything else? You worked on, what do you say, GNUnet? What kind of stuff did you do for it specifically?
What type of code did it write, or what type of stuff is the internet trying to address?
What's it trying to address besides the anonymity and things like that?
Well, the problem with every P2P system out there is, one, it's specific. Like, for instance, Freenet, mm-hmm. you can do some pretty cool things with it, but it really only is a peer-to-peer application. GNUnet's a framework. We have a peer-to-peer system running over it, but you can run, we have also a chat client. And so any application you write for it, it gives you anonymity, accounting. It's a flat network like mm-hmm. you're talking about. You connect to peers and you grab host lists. Mm-hmm. You say, these hosts participate in the network, but it's anonymous. You don't know how they participate.
Okay.
But then it kind of propagates out like that. A lot of it is a publisher model.
Okay.
Like, we were kind of interested in how can we change, like, a publisher, you know, how can we come up with a publishing model so that somebody can say, I have subscribed anonymously to these different things, I need to get my monthly updates, and then also medical records and stuff
okay.
like that.
Okay, do you think, so it does more than just maybe strictly peer-to-peer stuff, it's more of just a...
And on top of that, a problem with peer-to-peer networks is that once your university sees that 2 gigs a month are being used or more for peer-to-peer stuff, they just block that port.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way we get around that is that you can run our protocol over SMTP or HTTP or things
mm-hmm.
like that. And so they look at the protocol and they can't tell that it's actually peer-to-peer traffic. So, we get around some things like that.
Besides just the technological issues, there's also other issues surrounding peer-to-peer. Do you think it makes sense to let other people have access to your machine and use your resources to the greater good, even if you are getting some kind of payment for it, higher priority in a queue if you want a resource from the network? Is it, and by you maybe not wanting people to access your machine, you in turn hurt the network, so should you be forced to access it? Do you have some right to the data that's on the network, not just putting aside all that DMCA stuff about, you know, and the RIAA, all that crap about downloading, you know, other people's music and not paying for it and all that shit. But do you guys?
But you think that's okay?
Yeah, do you? I mean, I don't want to get into the issue. Well, we kind of can, if you want, about, you know, should musicians, you know.
Like artists that are, not making their bills because, not every artist is Britney Spears.
Oh, no, I totally understand. I mean, there was a special on MTV2, and the rapper 50 Cent, they went over, like, you know, what happens. You know, these artists get signed, they get, like, $1 million advance. They have to pay for all the studio production out of pocket, the video, lawyers, management, promotion, and they end up with like $35,000 when they're done. And all those things you see in the videos, like the Beamers and all that shit, they all rent. And it's just amazing. Yeah.
Like, that's if you're lucky.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and...
I think it's just...
he's a big rapper, too, you know?
That has to change with people. Like, they have to change their attitude with music and supporting artists.
Oh, I agree. There's too many middlemen involved, I think. I mean, getting to the artists. That's true.
They need to understand this is about them making a living. Well, and they have total rights to their work. I'm not getting to speaking out. They need to understand that not every artist can be Britney Spears. There's just not enough money to support them all to sell to which they'd like to invest.
I agree. And another branch of that argument is, do you think artists deserve to, you know, kind of getting into this here, do artists deserve to get paid millions of dollars for doing what they do? I mean, they're not pushing carts at Myers. They're not, you know, working at a Rouge steel plant. They're living a nice lifestyle, and they're famous, and they're getting paid millions of dollars. Well, I mean, a lot of them are. Yeah. Well, if you sell over 1 million albums, then you're in a category where you can live pretty. You can live the superstar lifestyle. I understand the people that don't. They come out with 300,000-400,000 albums and gets them nothing.
My brother's giving this concert, and after the concert, people like come up to him and wanted to sign shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
This guy like comes up with a burnt CD, mm-hmm. of his CD that just came out,
mm-hmm.
and asks him to sign it. He's like, "Hey, why don't you buy one of our CDs?"
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, because the guy was like, "Oh, I couldn't find your CD, so I burned it." He's like, "Well, like, now that you're here, why don't you support us?" And he's like, "Oh, I've already got it." You know, I think it's like that mentality that we have to crush. Not every artist out there is making a million. A lot of artists are, you know, they're barely paying their bills, and
mm-hmm.
they're just making music because they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we continue on the path that we're on, like, you know, people are just going to get, like, burnt out, and you're not going to get that creative music.
Oh, I agree. I got tired personally shelling out $20 for a CD when I only liked one song on it or two songs. I get kind of, it's wrong of me to feel suckered in, but I still feel like I got cheated. You know, they obviously put production value into those one or two songs, and they released them as singles. They do this, you know, on purpose, and I coughed up $20 for the CD. Now, if, like, one of my personal favorite bands is Radiohead comes out with an album, I buy it. Why? Because I don't buy it just to have it because I can go download it. I buy it because I want to support them and I want to hear their next album.
I mean, the steel industry in America is being flooded by cheap but equally good steel in Japan. And this is just stopped a couple of years ago, because Japan just screwed anywhere out of the system.
Way worse than us.
The steel industry in America started to die, and they had to change their business models. That's not the same thing with the record industry. If 50 Cent gets $1 million, he's not smart enough to do whatever and thrive off that $1 million. He's obviously not qualified in the market, the equilibrium behind that.
Well, keep in mind, too, that million, it's an advance that he has to pay back of every penny. So, I mean, before he sees a cent from any of the album sales, he has to pay the label back that $1 million, and then he gets a percentage of what comes in.
If he can pay it back with that record, the next record he cuts, he's still paying off
the last one. The record company never eats it unless he doesn't make a profit. The only time that you can always see money is after the record company makes all the costs.
Yeah, but I'm just saying
it's a business when it comes down to it. I mean, obviously.
It's give me $1 million to do that, I wouldn't complain about it.
No, I agree.
There was an interesting theory on Slash a while back that said artists should ask their fans for money, not to buy albums, but commit to, as an artist, I'll produce, you know, 10 songs this year, or this many minutes of music, I need to make $100 this year's name. So here's my tip, Charles. If I meet this requirement every month, you know, I say I need $50,000 a year, so I need $50,000 to meet my bills to continue being an artist. If I meet that, I put my time into doing artistry work. You know, I create songs, I release them to you, I release them to the world at large.
Isn't that like ransoming your fans, though? You're like, if you pay my demands, I'll put that
in. Well, it makes it entirely democratic, because if I like his music, and I really like his music, and, you know, he's just not making the money he needs to, then if 10 fans love him enough to support him at $50,000 a year, you know, $5,000 a piece, okay, you know, he's got his money. If you know, he's got 100,000 fans, he maybe only 50 cents each year.
What kind of implications would a scheme like that have? I mean, the whole peer-to-peer idea, and I'm tying everything back into peer-to-peer here, but is to, because everybody's a peer and everybody's essentially equal within the whatever kind of model it is, that you eliminate a lot of these middlemen.
They have universal distribution.
Hmm. It becomes the first time they don't need every company. So why don't artists, instead of signing contracts with labels, just post their music online and have people, you know, set up an e-commerce site where they buy their music.
It's an oligopoly. There's barriers to entry.
Such as radio, and the problems with, you know, the conglomerates like Clear Channel owning all these radio stations, and you actually having to basically bribe your way in to get on the air.
Madonna actually just released a single.
I think I
wide open MP3.
Heard about that.
And for like $1.40, just released. I was gonna buy it.
Now, would you consider going on Kazaa first and listening to it, and if you liked it, going back and buying it?
At this point, I'm just happy somebody's doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I would prefer to just get all my music off Kazaa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I like what I hear, I, you know, send them, you know, 50 cents or $1. And, you know, they would make just as much money bypassing the pool.
But then you break part of the machine too, because I mean you have it gets complex because you have radio is a mechanism to kind of broadcast, you know, it's a mechanism by the labels to allow them to showcase what's coming out next.
Well, but what about online radio where like it doesn't matter how popular, like for instance Live 365, you can just start a station and you can play music from all these different artists, you know, subject to a few restrictions.
There's a lot more restrictions now than there were. I mean, it used to be wide open, and then they tried charging per connection, a fraction of a cent per hour of play per user, and it got ridiculous. They just recently, I think, fourth quarter last year, decided it's a percentage of the revenue you make off the music you broadcast online. So it's instead of per listener, it's a percentage of your revenue. Easy way around that nonprofit org that's doing it. But there was something on Penn the other day about one of the local NPR stations or something getting blasted or shutting down their online stream because they got a letter or a nasty gram from somebody.
P2P provides an interesting ability to sidestep a lot of the barriers to entry for online artistry. Because if you're going to stream media, it costs you bandwidth, and if you're going to provide files, it takes space. Another one that online comments, GPF, any of user-friendly, their major costs every month are bandwidth, something that we all have plenty of. We consume it to pull it down, and then it just gets lost in our cache files. There's no reason why we can't turn around and share that back out.
But the problem is, if you look at a peer-to-peer model, then your problem is you have this small world heuristic where you have a few nodes with a very high degree of connectivity. You have, that are on all the time and that have visibility of more of the network because they see nodes come and go.
Well, but that depends on the model, too.
This is
like,
true, but in a true...
If you take into account, like... Yeah,
well, I mean, that's what the small world heuristic is. It's separation. Nutella happened to follow it, and people don't really know why. And there's people...
Way to do it.
There's people analyzing, but they didn't program it to do it. It actually... It evolved. There's this natural thing. In nature, the small world heuristic is a fact.
Yeah.
And it's a proven, you know, hypothesis. But, I mean, the scientists have proven that the small world heuristic exists. And then people started analyzing Nutella and found that it started popping up there. And wait, whoa, this is an artificial creation. Why in the hell is this happening?
Can you explain a little bit more why that's a problem? And I'm not too familiar with what
Well, the small world heuristic, it's, you have, when I say high degree, a node has a very high degree, that means it has a lot of connections. It's essentially a server, but it's not a server. Just visibility. For example, like a super peer or super node in any of these peer-to-peer networks, it's a node that has been there long enough to be elevated to this super peer or super node status. And it has, it's a preferred provider of information about the network. So if a node's a super node or a super peer, other nodes are going to look to find those guys because they've been on the longest. They have the most information about the topology of the network. They know the IP addresses of the machines, where they're at, how long they've been up there, etc. So there's a very high degree of connectivity. There's a lot of links between that one machine and other machines, as opposed to nodes that are leafs, that are like dial-up users come in and exit the network very quickly.
Right.
That, but what happens?
Intelligent analysis of the network is saying, you know, this is a university network. I've noticed that GPF is pulling 50 hits a day here. So let's not send from the supernode. Where, you know, mm-hmm. where is it? Who can I get it from? Maybe pull from outside. Let's send this one guy, and then that one guy on that network advertises to all the people who are likely to use the medium of sending him this file. He has it. And he may not even know he has it, just based on his past behavior.
The problem is, one of the caveats with a true peer-to-peer model is that nodes should be able to come and go as they wish at will from the network, and it shouldn't impact the network at all. A lot of these leaf nodes are the ones, the reason they are leaf nodes is because they come into the network and they leave so rapidly that their information, their geometry is lost.
But not to them. They remember
They remember it, but that the information they have becomes legacy because if they've been separated from the network. If there's a file floating around the network, let's say Joe User has a Britney Spears MP3, and he's a leaf node. He's a dial-up user. There's another dial-up user that did a search for that MP3, and he found Joe User had it. The problem is Joe User may not be there the next time that guy wants to get that file. So that resource would be cached informationally in the network. You would know where it's at, but it might not be reachable. Well, that's, you start getting into profiling. There's other projects out there like Cord and Circle or a couple other peer-to-peer projects where they work on a little different idea where the nodes are arranged in a circular pattern and different data types are mapped to different nodes. There's actually hash keys generated for a specific type of data. We'll use a Britney Spears MP3 again because she's pretty hot. But so somebody has a lot of Britney Spears material. They're the preferred provider of information on where Britney Spears crap is in the network. And so when you do a Britney Spears search, it'll generate a hash key that maps to that node, and that becomes the node's address. And so the idea is that you can set like a delta in the circle. And so you can make cords between nodes, and you're never like two or three cords away from your data. And essentially, if you remove a node from that circle, the circle just closes up. But that data is not available again. It may map to that hash key, may map to a node that's no longer in the circle. You know where it's at, you know where to look for it, but if it's not there, it does you no good.
See, that's kind of problematic, though, because, like, for anonymity, like, you don't want to know what node is associated with data.
Well, different peer-to-peer projects like Freenet, their goal is anonymity. It's not total distribution of information.
Sure. But if you look at, like, trend of the RAA, mm-hmm. like they've actually been actively hiring companies to infiltrate peer-to-peer networks.
Oh, I know. I tried to download. There's a band called Evanescence, and you know they had a decent song, so I wanted to get some of their other stuff and see if they were worth checking into. I see all this stuff from them. Great, and because I go to download it, you know, and they're bad MP3s. They're And you can tell because it's one or two users for each one of these songs. They're just bad. You listen to a few seconds, you get some hissing, or it's just garbled, and it's this garbage.
There's an article on Slashdot about that. There's companies that are salting the data, so to speak, and putting all those bad MP3s and everything.
They're doing other things, too. They nabbed a guy in Chicago, and I'm not sure how they did it, but the way I can conceptualize how to do it is become somebody that has the entire RIA's catalog of music. And let's say you connect to a peer-to-peer network, you have the entire catalog you're sharing. Do this 500 times, have all those peers talk to each other, and see which users are requesting songs. And you can create a correlation engine, find out, okay, Joe User requested all these MP3s, and you have all these different points of contact that he made within the network. You correlate that data together, and the guy got nailed for downloading 300 songs in a day. It doesn't sound like a lot. They caught him.
They made an example out of them.
I don't remember what the fine was. It was SWAT. They overblew it, of course, and hauled him off as an example. And he was on, I think, Roadrunner. So it was a cable modem provider. Now that's good. There's a provision, as bad as the DMCA is, there's a provision in it that says ISPs are not responsible for the actions of their users.
I understand.
They're trying to get leverage. The RIA is trying to get leverage like hell, but that's one of the caveats some senator threw in. And it is worded that way. They don't want to, it's one of those.
Once you're informed of a user abusing your property, I'm Disney. And somebody is distributing Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
I know that At Home is the facilitator of this piracy.
Mm-hmm.
I send them an email or a letter saying cease and desist this action immediately.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you are held responsible. At that point on, that internet provider is now liable.
It's proved true. Respond.
So if you send out a download request saying, I'd like this, the node that receives that actually doesn't know what type of request that is. And likewise, if you're downloading something from a node, that node has no clue whether they're asking for a file or just forwarding something from someone else or what they're doing.
You're basically creating a double-blind system within the peer-to-peer node.
Well, and you need to do that. I mean, and we've seen that through legislation and certainly recent inquiries into peer users.
But I mean, other ways. I mean, like I said, they're hiring these firms to put out all these dummy nodes, and on the back end, they're correlating all the metrics from the nodes are collecting, and that's they can bypass the ISPs right away and say, hey, we have proof. Here it is. What do you mean show up with 30,000 files?
You show up with Ria's entire catalog.
Okay.
You're dealing with hundreds of thousands of vendors.
Then you need to start bringing some kind of profiling mechanism into that.
But that has to be built in for this to progress to be reasonable.
Well, but I think you're thinking about the peer-to-peer model in a way that you're saying that someone can say, this person showed up with all of these things, okay? Now, let's say the RIA, they hop on a network and they say, we have all of these files, people can search for them. A query comes in, they can't tell what type of query that is. Okay? And so, okay.
Well, you're saying they have messed with the client.
Well, even when they have messed with the client, you can make some guarantees about what type, and this isn't an economic model, like we're saying, like, if you have an economic model for your system, sure, they can send out 10 or 15 or 20 queries, but when people start getting a whole bunch of bogus, you know, stuff from these people, eventually they're going to start saying, this person's not actually doing me a favor, okay? And so they'll do something to deal with that, okay? And so I think something that people need to start looking towards is looking at peer-to-peer in a different way. And not just, you know, the Windows sharing idea. People have this, I can look it up in this directory and I can download it from those people. Because, you know, legislation isn't going to look at
it. One of the interesting things that occurred on Slashdot was the encrypted section on your hard drives. You've got a portion of your hard drive reading, you don't know what's on it. Your client doesn't know what's on it. All it knows is that whatever's on it responds to this key that is one way encryptable to some node that holds additional information, which in this method, if we cache the Britney Spears MP3 that we think the college is really going to want based on our profile, you know, whoever's got it doesn't know they have it. The MP3, and the RIA can't track them down for it, because even if they nail their computer, there's nothing on it for them to get. And all you need is that key that says, you know, here is the file I'm looking for. And then someone knows that file name was associated with that key. And unless you can get all, you know, 3 or 4 components of this together in a chain, and by the time RIA actually has enough of those elements in there to get that chain, they become a significant contributor to the network. And either they're contributing real content, or you can judge them as being a bad part of your network and not very contributing monitoring because of the trust. So they'll either give out files, in which case it becomes entrapped, or else they won't give out files, in which case they get kicked out of the network.
Well, there are systems that actually do that. There are systems that allow you to do those types of things. So I think the problem is, like a lot of peer-to-peer systems, it seems to be like what becomes popular with college students is what becomes what people know about. And, you know, there are a lot of people doing research in peer-to-peer, and that's where a lot of really neat things are going on. You know, and some of them are practical, some of them aren't.
And it's a way of thinking, too, because the more you start to profile the network and the more restrictions you place on it, you will eventually fall into, in my opinion, devolve into a client-server model. If you start, you know, bumping out all these leaves because they don't meet a certain criteria, and they can never evolve.
But you can set your criteria on the leaf level, so I makes it more tolerant to errors if I'm willing to judge, you know, that this person is something I think that
But if you can't apply something, see, that's very difficult because the network is so diverse, so distributed. If you can't apply something across the board, you're going to start segregating the network.
One of the other issues you have to look at with the network is it has to have some actual justification for existence besides files.
Oh, I agree.
So at some point, we have to tie businesses into it and say, this is your disaster network, and you're sharing files out onto our network in some form that no one else can ever access them. So if you ever do need to fail, where all you need is one client machine and the right password, you're in.
And you know, we're talking about files and you know, intellectual property, things like that, as being the resources you share. But it could be, you know, tons of other things. It could be, of course, compute cycles. It could be any other of a number of resources that you have that you can share to a disk space. So it's not just file sharing, and that's a mentality a lot of people have. You mentioned peer to peer. They're like, oh, Napster. MP3 file swapping, things like that. So, God, I'm surprised. We originally weren't going to have this panel, but chewed up almost 40 minutes. Any other questions? Any other thoughts on?
From my experience working at Michigan State and talking with people that actually helped write the laws of the DMCA and work with the FCC, what you guys are talking about, like with the laws and stuff about how if an ISP gets a letter from Disney, and they're saying, if this user is doing this, they're going to believe Disney over the user. They're not going to investigate. They're going to cut your access off. They don't cut their own because
it's too much trouble.
It's too skewed.
Yeah.
But you're thinking that you have a voice in it, but you kind of don't.
agree.
You're just paying $30 a month for internet access. They give two shits about you.
I agree.
You know, if you're giving them shit, just get the fuck out of the room.
I totally agree with you on that. And they just don't. They'd rather, instead of dealing with the trouble of actually investigating the situation, they'll just cut you off at the knees. Because why? I mean, you're a number. You're one of the herd. So.
You're causing trouble.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about legal implications, but certainly in information security, there's lots of ways to circumvent legalities of some technology.
Oh, there's tons of ways. And one of them I just glanced on earlier, the new pricing model that was agreed upon, actually dictated to the RIA and webcasters, was that it's a percentage of the revenue the website brings in. If the website streams any type of media and they don't generate a profit off it, you can create a nonprofit organization as a legal form and shield yourself from that kind of scrutiny.
Is it revenue or is it like?
It's profit. It's profit, actually. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's profit. If you can't benefit from, but who's to say that? And it gets murky still, because if people come to your site for the streaming media and you're displaying, you know, 15 ads to them and you're getting money off that and you do generate a profit, you know, it's tough to say that somebody's going there for the music, but they're also doing other things.
What I'm kind of curious about is, like I said, we're talking about these legal implications, but you can certainly circumvent them with better technological implementations of peer-to-peer networks. Like lots of technology in the field that people here work in, computing is in its infancy, so why aren't people just looking towards ways to, you know, completely circumvent the system or, you know, work within the confines of the system. You know, like a lot of digital libraries are looking at how can we, you know, have this kind of digital checkout system, you know, and things like that, so that.
I don't know, if you look at the climate, it's not, people, you're right, people don't put a whole lot, I mean, other than projects that go for the anonymity, like Freenet and things like that, people haven't traditionally put a lot of energy into breaking it necessarily. People would rather stand up and scream that this shouldn't be happening and this is why it shouldn't be happening. After, it's a democracy, you know, the mass should get what it wants. And that's the mentality that people have. So, I mean, you know, why work to break something that's wrong and flawed in the first place?
Well,
that shouldn't be there.
In this country, but yeah. Like in China or lots of other countries where, you know, there's no sense of democracy.
Oh, I agree. But I mean, there's, you get into geopolitical boundaries too. I mean, how, not, it's an age-old argument. The internet's global. How are you going to apply things like taxes to it? Mandatory taxes. You know, if somebody from China buys something from Texas, a Texas e-commerce site, he's not going to want to pay Texas sales tax. And how are they going to enforce something like that? I mean, you can spoof your IP, you can spoof your Mac. I mean, how are they going to know you're coming from China? As an example.
Terrorists involved also.
Always terrorists. It's everywhere. It's crazy. But, I mean, not to be cynical, but, yeah, I mean, I don't doubt that terrorists could use these mechanisms. Oh, I thought you said terrorists. Oh, my God.
That was just really off topic.
Yeah. But, yeah, you're right. You know, just other political, you know, geopolitical taxation mechanisms.
Actually, most issues of taxation can be easily resolved
by not paying.
Well, no, on items going out of the country because they all go to customs. So if something's going out of the country, you know where it's been shipped to. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where it's ending up, it matters where it's shipped to. And if that country's responsibility to tax it beyond that one. And the same thing on the less. I mean, if you have to declare what's in your package, you get an element of Big Brother there, but it's fairly easy to tax things going from state to state. Mm-hmm. You know, if you said about, you know, flat tax, you'd say it's 8%. Well, I know that they package them from California to Florida, and so here's 8% tax on the, you know, what that was. It doesn't matter where it goes.
So, should we still get our music for free, and do we deserve to?
Oh, yeah.
Hell yeah.
No, I gotta say no. I like peer-to-peer systems, but personally, like, I take your point of view. If there's an album that I only like one song, I download that. But when you're making not much money a month anyway, that actually makes a huge difference.
I can understand. I definitely understand. I'm getting kicked out, aren't I? Huh?
No, go ahead.
I'm surprised I'm even talking at this point. There were like two people in here when I started, so you guys on it tonight?
Continue.
We're talking about whether we deserve to download music for free, among other things. Yeah.
Depends on what kind of music it is.
Ah.
If it's music that an artist puts out there in order to get promotion, yeah. But if an artist puts music out there that's copyrighted and all that stuff, then you got an artist you really
remember it. How would you tell the difference?
For other reasons, though. But I mean, there's a stink because 50 Cent's album came out 2 weeks early on like Kazaa or something, and he was on all his interviews. He was all for it. I mean, it's a promotional tool just like radio is. But the difference is there's organizations that control radio, the conglomerates like Clear Channel and things of that nature. You know, there is a you have to blackmail people. You have to, you know, slip them money to get your singles on the radio. I mean, that's the way it is. There's people that work at radio stations. Their role is specifically to bargain these deals with record labels to get their music out. Oh, yeah, that's just like getting into the fraternity. That's, you know, that's going through, you know, Rush. But, I mean, once you're in that, that's it. Okay. That's it, I'm done. Thanks guys for sticking around.